Welcome to Theatre Audience Podcast. I'm Natalie, joined by Darren, and we bring you the news, reviews and recommendations of the latest theatre.
We'll be discussing what's on, what's been and gone, and the next hot ticks.
Morning, Darren. Welcome back from, was it sunny Berlin?
It was not sunny Berlin as such, but it was certainly warmer than London Berlin, yes.
Yeah, we've had an odd weather. The temperature's dropped massively, and then we've had a couple of nice sort of warmer 12 degrees sunny days and then back to cold. So it's been rather confusing of late.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is winter, but I'm not used to having the frosty mornings. So for 8 days when I was in Berlin, it was nice. A little bit wet on certain days, but not as cold as here.
And how was it? How was the film festival? How'd you get on?
Oh, the film festival, Berlinale, was brilliant. It's my first time actually at a foreign film festival, and most of the ones I go to are actually UK-based, so that was an experience within itself. Berlin, as a city, love it. I could commute there, live there for a while, love the vibe. The people are cool, the places to go to are great. It just feels nice. It feels like a really welcoming, lovely metropolitan city. The films I saw, most of which were great fun. Some, one or two of them were a bit, okay, I'm not sure why they were programmed, but you know, it's a festival for everybody, and what I like, someone else might not like, and such, same as theatre, you know. So I met some wonderful people. I got some great contacts for my film work, so we'll see what happens next.
Oh, how fantastic. I've been following it on your Instagram, obviously, and it looked like you had an absolute blast. So congrats with all that, and good to hear, because I know you've got some exciting scripts kind of ready to go.
I know, ready to go, just wait for the finance, and then I could get on and start working on my feature. So yeah, so I've been in Berlin, and what have you been doing?
Well, you know, I've been doing the day-to-day, preparing my A-level GCSE students, going out and watching A-level students at other schools and colleges, and examining their stuff. But really loving my course at Royal Central School of Speech and Drama. It's been really great going back to drama school on a Tuesday evening and mixing with adult creatives and working on materials, creating a solo show. And you know what? I've really enjoyed the section that we did on stand-up comedy and got really, really good feedback from the course leader and other members on the course. So I'm going to kind of start pursuing a bit of stand-up potentially. So I'm creating a 5-minute set for this week. And I went to the Museum of Comedy and watched a couple of comedians there and got quite inspired. So I'm really excited. It's quite a challenge, but I'm loving it.
I didn't think you were that funny, Natalie.
Oh, piss off.
I'd have to come and see you, throw some eggs and cabbages at you.
Oh, thanks. That'd be
heckle
lovely.
Heckle you. I'm not going to heckle you.
Oh, God. You'd heckle me, and then it'd end up being a two-person show, and we'd just end up going into podcast mode, wouldn't it, really? I'd be like, have you brought your Earl Grey tea? Is it in a flask, dear?
Yeah, yes, dear, it's in a flask.
You got your slippers.
Oh, I've got my slippers on right now, actually. And my dressing gown, because I'm a little bit chilly in my South London apartment, as it were.
Little Sunday morning. I've been up for hours, actually. So, I'm dressed and ready to go. But, right. So, what have we said? You've only been back a short time, but you've been busy, busy and out to the theatre and interviewing and whatnot. So, you went to Hampstead Theatre. Tell me about the show.
Yeah, I literally flew in on Thursday afternoon, dumped my case, quickly ate a sandwich and shot all the way over to North London to Hampstead Theatre for the opening night of Outer Season. Now, Outer Season is Neil D'Souza's new play, directed by Alice Hamilton. And it's a play for us, Natalie. It's late 40-somethings going to Ibiza for the first time in...
Wait a minute. Let me just stop you on the late 40s. I'm 46. Can we just clarify your late 40s? But anyway, carry on.
Oh, what's a number? I mean, it's still going to creep up. But anyway, around our age then, And they go to Ibiza for the first time, almost like a reunion. And it's a couple of friends, and they're in the same hotel room they were in literally the time before, which was like 25 or so years ago. And what's really lovely about it, which for as a personal story, is set in 1995. And no, it's set now, sorry, but they were in Ibiza in 1995. So what's that, nearly 30 years ago? And I was in Ibiza in 1995. I was living out there for the summer season. I was working for a club called Amnesia. It's still there, but it's a very different club now. And I had my space tag, my little tag that got me into all the venues and stuff. So it was really cool to kind of reminisce and thinking, oh my God. But there, they went back to a hotel where I was in an apartment. And it was the scene that apparently had not changed. The same decor, the same everything. Oh, the only difference is apparently they'd upgraded the room to a premium room. And one of the gags that comes in is like, well, what's premium about it? And apparently there's an abstract piece of art on the wall, and that enables it to become a premium room on a higher kind of, like, I guess a cost per night, as it were, a piece of fake Picasso. But it was really fun, and it's really great. I've known Neil for a while, and we interviewed him, and he was in a previous podcast, him and James Hillier, who's one of the actors in the piece. And it was really lovely. It's 2 hours of an interview. It was really fun. It was really fun. Like, the staging was really great. You felt you were in that hotel room. They had the balcony area overlooking the kind of the strip where all the drunks and that were. And you could hear all the noise. And it was like bringing back all these memories of all these, like, instances where people were just, you know, probably throwing up on the streets and just screaming and laughing and being thrown out of clubs and all sorts of stuff. Very British, apparently. And then, you know, they had like an ensuite little shower room and stuff, and the bed. But the bed was the twin beds that were put together. And the gag came in, it's like, oh my God, they're giving us a double bed. It's like, no, it's twin beds. And he's trying to put them apart, and they're not putting apart. And yeah, but it was really fun. It was really fun. And it's certainly a play for our age group, for the 40 plus, because it's about reminiscing about the past and stuff, and rekindling relationships, finding new relationships. And I mean, he's had a wonderful 4-star Guardian review, which I think is well deserved. Definitely well deserved. The writing, the comedies on it, there's some really good poignant moments where the central characters are kind of like finding themselves as adults, but still kind of reminiscing on how they were when they were younger, when they were good, really good friends. And moments like there's a scene with the wardrobe becomes not a character within itself, but quite a poignant and important piece of the set. I'm not going to give away why, because obviously listeners want to go and see it and find out for themselves. And but yeah, it was really, really nice. I mean, it's a small cast. It was just a cast of five. We got Caitrin Aaron, who played Amy. Wonderful. I really felt for her. Like, there's some really cool moments where she's going, like, all these nice kind of roller coaster of emotions when she's trying to get on with Peter Bramall, who plays Chris. And I can't tell you too much on here, because I want to give things away, but really, really great performances from all around. And then Kerry Bennett plays Holly again. You know, she's the kind of like divorcee mother going out to Ibiza just to have a good time with her best friend. You know, her family are family at home, ex-husband, you know, looking after the kid and stuff, and she just wants to have a good time, like she would have done if, you know, when she was in her early 20s. And then you got Dev, who's played by Neil D'Souza, again, really good emotional connection to his part, great comedy, and I mean, he wrote the lines, so I guess he knew how to say them. But and then finally the villain of the piece, which is Michael, played by James Hillier. And again, I'm not going to go into too much detail about how he was the villain, because obviously people want to see this, but he plays it very, very well. But I think he played a villain in EastEnders, actually, so maybe his casting. But I think you would enjoy it, Natalie. I really do think so. But it's not on for very long, is that, because obviously Hampstead Downstairs, they have a limited, normally about 5 or 6 weeks season, and so it finishes on the 23rd of March. But it's definitely one to see.
Oh, it's Downstairs,
it's
it?
Downstairs, yes.
Okay, so that's even less tickets available. No, I'm going to go based on this. I'm going to squeeze it in, because I've just worked out, do you know what? This is really hilarious. I've had loads of conversations with friends that I've known for a long time over the last week, where I've discovered random things about them that I didn't know. I didn't know that you worked in Amnesia, and I didn't know that you were there in 95. I was actually there in 95. I was 18. I'd just done my A-levels and I went out there.
Oh, wow. I was there with my sister.
Like literally. And I remember going to sort of Es Paradis and the phone parties and the, was it 20s? He's gone 20s holidays or 19 to 30, you know, those club holidays. And the rep had kind of latched onto me and my friend and just like walked us into every single club. And, you know, we had drinks paid for us and everything. So I thought I'd really enjoy this. And I was actually talking this year about the possibility of going out to Ibiza for like a long weekend or something like that in summer. So I think this one is for me. When did you say it's on till?
Till the 23rd of March. But when I was out there in 95, I mean, I'd just finished university and I was there for the summers with my sister Lisa. So speak to Lisa about Ibiza because she goes there quite a lot. And the kids, it's funny because my nephews are now 21 and they go there as well. And it's just nice. It's just like a family thing where we're younger, things to do. But Nietzsche was great. It was an outdoor club. It was had an indoor space, but it was an outdoor club. It had all like lovely gardens and a river running through it and stuff. Now that's all gone. But I remember with my space tag, it meant that I'd made it. And that's all that was important to me at that time, at 21 in Ibiza, living a life as one of the reps there. But yeah, no, it was great fun. But moving on from that, because it's very different and a different piece completely, but this is an Oscar Wilde play. It's Lady Windermere's Fan. Do you know the piece?
Yes, I do. I'm a great Oscar Wilde fan. I have read most of the plays in the past and studied them in depth at university as well. But so where's this on?
Oh, it's now finished. It finished. It's only a week long. So this is Lady Windermere's Fan on air. So the idea is it's actually a radio play. They've done it as a radio play. Apparently they do it quite a lot because obviously they're quite cheap to slot in and stuff. Because the stage is very minimal and the actors, there's only one day rehearsal, I found out from Olivia Hanlan, who's a dear friend of mine. That's why I went to see it. So she played Mrs. Erlin. Do you know the character Mrs. Erlin? Like the kind of villainess kind of, but not really. She's portrayed as that, but she's actually a very kind-hearted woman. But it was really good fun. Obviously, it's a matinee for me because it's a Saturday matinee, and it was full of the silver rinse, obviously, because you'd expect it in Windsor and obviously for a matinee. But you know what? I didn't know what to expect when Olivia said, "Oh no, it's a stage version of a radio play." I thought, "Oh, they're all going to be wearing black, sitting on chairs, you know, just." Reading out to the audience, it reminded me somewhat of a Jamie Lloyd show where it's completely stripped back and they're talking out with their microphones to the audience. They're not interacting with each other, and but this was much better than that play with the seagull. Ugh, dial. Anyway, so but I really enjoyed it. It was lovely to see Olivia back on stage. I haven't seen her on stage since, I think, Flare Path when I was doing a tour, because she's had a child now and she's getting back interacting. And she is wonderful. I mean, you know, she, even though it was a radio play, the emotional connection was there to the part. You know, she was really living that character. And when she said it was only one day rehearsal, thinking, oh my goodness. But I guess they've all got scripts in their hands. So all they're doing is talking out to the audience, but they still have to have that connection.
Yeah.
I mean, on the whole, it was a really good piece. I'm glad I got to see it. And it wasn't a play I was actually familiar with, to be fair. I thought I knew it, but I mean, I knew how it was going to kind of end, because the whole kind of like, you know, oh, I'm her mother kind of like, you know, plot twist and stuff. But what's really interesting is after watching this play yesterday, also what I liked, we're going to go to now, is all the Foley work. So you had the actors doing all the noise stuff, opening the letters,
oh, lovely.
Doing the door, doing the tea, the rattling tray when the butler came in with the tea tray and stuff, all that stuff. So you really felt you were in.
Oh, involved. Lovely!
So some of it, I hope it didn't look like I was sleeping, but I actually had my eyes closed, ugh. So I didn't get that whole kind of impression of like what it'd be like to listen to it on the radio. So yeah, but I really enjoyed it. But as I said, it's one of the plays I wasn't overly familiar with, but I do think Oscar Wilde, although I think it stands up now, I do think they're incredibly hard to do, if I'm honest. because the language, obviously, we don't particularly use so much. And a lot of it is, there's a lot of innuendo. There's a lot of stuff that, does she mean this and things? And I think a lot of the gags get lost. I think it's a piece, Oscar Wilde in general here, where you've got to have a really good, strong director that can really help the actors pull out all those pieces. Otherwise, they just get lost.
Yeah,
I think that's what I'm getting. Because after seeing Andrew Scott, I don't remember which one he did now, The Old Vic, but that was brilliant again because I think the director really helped pull out all those nuances and the emotional connection to those actors. Because I've seen Oscar Wilde done so flippantly, where it's done for laughs and there's no truth in what the characters are saying, which where the actors haven't direction or their own choices, where they haven't emotionally connected to that piece and kept it in that time. I did The Importance of Being Earnest was part of my Meister training, certain scenes, and it's interesting doing that play, but in the Meisner exercise where you're really connecting with the other person and really responding to what it is they're saying to you. So I think, I don't know if you do any Oscar Wilde at school, do you?
I haven't recently. I often thought about it being quite fun as a, like a sixth form production, but it's, I always need to include as many people as possible. And sometimes that can limit you to sort of eight main characters with, a few kind of add-ons with sort of servant parts or whatever, which is not always enough characters. But importance of being, Ernest being one of those examples. But yeah, it's all about playing, well, with any comedy, isn't it? You've got to be absolutely in the moment and believable. And it's all about the language and the pauses and the intonation on the correct words in order, to get that humour across. But yeah, I'd like to see more Oscar Wilde. But as you say, these pieces, it definitely lends itself more to an audience of the Silver Rince, as you say. That draws that crowd. It's more of a provincial theatre staple theatre piece now rather than a big West End production in current theatre land, I feel.
Yeah, no, I think that's incredibly true. But I just looked up and I got it completely wrong. It wasn't Oscar Wilde that Andrew Scott did. It was actually a Noel Coward play, Present Laughter. So again, on the same guise of using that kind of humour in their characterizations, finding the truth of what it is that character really wants and is saying. So I think Noel Coward is another prime example of it could be done so badly. And I have seen it done so badly, sadly. But yeah, but like I said, I'm really thrilled I got to see it. I love seeing Olivia Hallinan on stage. The rest of the company were really good. I think one day rehearsal was a bit not great for anybody, but there you go. But I'm really glad I got to see it. Moving on from this one, just a quick mention. I went to Theatre 503 last night to see a friend of mine in his play, I Just Like You, which is a gay myth. Have you been to 503?
I haven't. I get a lot of info comes through from Theatre 503, but did you say it's in Clapham?
Yeah, it's in, Clapham Junction, Battersea area. It's a new writer's kind of like forum. They really champion new writing and they do a lot of support for new writers and new writing. They're actually launching a new building subject to raising the funds in Nine Elms, which is going to be a safe space for writers to explore their talents and basically like kind of either establish themselves and help develop their plays, which I think is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it's actually frustrating because you think they only want the 1.5 million and you're like, well, come on, Cameron McIntosh, put your hand in your wallet. You've got all these other producers that are making a lot of money on big shows and have a lot of money, a lot of clout. And you think, well, without these writers, you have no work. So start throwing some money into new writing. I mean, obviously, Soho Theatre, the Royal Court, they all champion new writing. But I think it's really nice that Theatre 503 is finally expanding and still keeping the ethos of helping establish new writing and stuff. But this play was fun. It was a two-hander. It was basically about two guys kind of love bombing, love addiction, love avoidance, going round and round, like, me in a club, one guy's not really up for a relationship, the other guy really is, and then it's like this kind of going around in circles type thing. But it was really wonderfully staged. What I loved about it was there was a lot of sex in it without actually having any nudity, because they had kind of choreographed it in a certain way where the pants were on, but they used a cushion to kind of like show that they're kind of doing stuff.
A cushion.
I don't want to tick that explicit box, so I can't go into too much detail. So yeah, but you know, Connor Mainwaring was playing Leo, and Pat was played by Chandler James, and is directed and written and stuff by Zachary Wilcox. But like I said, the movement director and the kind of choreography in their stuff was what kind of made it for me, because I thought it was really well done. At first, it was a little bit odd, and then I got used to it. So yeah, because I'm so used to seeing gay plays where they just get everything off and start stimulating sex scenes and stuff like that. So it's like it's quite refreshing when it's not done, because it actually doesn't matter too much. But that was done by Rupert Lawrence Worth, so definitely a good mention for him. But yeah, it's finished now. It's only on for 3 performances, a couple of days. I think it was on before. It's probably got life in it to do something else. But yeah, I just wanted to give it a quick mention. So Theatre 503, thank you for championing new writing, and keep going and doing wonderful work. So thank you. So that's me talking with my kind of sore throat from Berlin. You saw The Big Life, Stratford East.
Oh, Darren, I have had such an amazing run of seeing great musicals recently that this did not disappoint. This has just kept me on that trajectory of seeing what I consider to be just 5-star, amazing, vibrant, energetic, feel-good musicals. So this is called The Big Life, and the book and lyrics are by Paul Sirrett, and book by Tamika Ebsen. She's on EastEnders, and the music by Paul Joseph, and directed by Tanuka Craig. This is on until March the 30th, and before I even start speaking, I want people to start trying to buy their tickets, because actually there are not that many tickets left. And it's a small venue, very intimate, beautiful venue. I love Stratford East, and I love the things that they have on. And I don't think I've ever seen a bad show there, if I'm perfectly honest. And so there's only kind of like single tickets dotted about. So if you can get one of these, it is one of those productions that you will look back and remember it as one of the best things you've seen. So it's set in 1950s London. It's about 4 central characters, Ferdy, Bernie, Dennis and Lenny. And they start on the boat and they arrive from the West Indies, and they are full of expectations and aspirations. They're really optimistic, and this is the story of the Windrush. And they're beginning to think about how they're going to build their new life in London. For me, it's an incredible story, and told beautifully in Small Island at the National Theatre, which I saw, was that a couple of years ago, which that poignantly tells the story of the Windrush generation. And that is a play, and it's a very different feel and vibe to this. You have got that serious story, but it is coloured in beautiful, vibrant storytelling and musical theatre. And ska music. So this, I knew I was going to love it because I love ska music. And for me, the Windrush story is incredibly important because my grandmother was part of the Windrush generation, and she travelled over from Barbados with my grandfather, who I never met because he died before I was born, sadly, and he was from British Guyana. And he worked on a plantation and had worked his way up really high. And he was West Indian, so that I'm sort of third generation Bajan West Indian, which is it's a part of my culture that I don't really know or understand enough of. And actually watching this production, it made me feel quite emotive because I realised that I don't know a huge amount about my roots, and that's something that I really want to do more of. So lots of conversations with my dad to come, because sadly my nana is no longer with us, but I just want to know more about, you know, what life was like in Barbados at the time. So anyway, enough about me, back to the story. And so, you know, these people thought that London was paved, you know, the streets of England, of London, were paved with gold,
and they have this, you know, amazing idea of what life will be like. Ferdy, Bernie, Dennis and Lenny meet Sybil, Mary, Zuleika and Kathy, although two of them were a couple, but they have a bit of a fight on the boat and then come together later on. And the guys decide that for 3 years, they're not going to have any women, they're not going to have any wine, and they're just going to focus on their future. But the women have other ideas. And they're intercepted by, there's a lot of the staging happens in Piccadilly Circus near the Eros, but I won't say too much about the Eros character or the Mrs. Aphrodite narrator character, which is played by Tamika Epson. She is absolutely hilarious as the sort of, she's Mrs. Aphrodite, but she's kind of that West Indian auntie Jamaican character, quite cantankerous, and has her own views and talks to us from the box, and literally it is like a little mini stand-up comedy routine that runs through the whole piece, which is brilliant. So it's about the joyful and uplifting journey. It takes the story of Shakespeare's Love's Labour's Lost, and then it meets the Windrush generation, and it's fun packed with ska musical. And you've got the band on stage, up at the top, sort of at the back. So it's just vibrant. This production was actually done 20 years ago at Stratford East when it premiered. And then it did have a subsequent West End transfer. And I hope to God that this has a West End transfer. It's so fantastic. And I think, you know, if you think about the fact that, you know, most of the Windrush generation, sadly, are now no longer with us. If my nana was with us now, she'd be 101 or 103, I think. And so it's really, really important for the new generation to watch this and learn about their roots and their history. And also for people who know nothing about the Windrush generation to watch this show, because it's just a brilliant musical overall. And I was writing my notes. I was like, it's an incredibly witty, feel-good musical with an outstanding cast, vibrant, high-octane energy, but juxtaposed with those poignant, serious, historic moments. On the trigger warning, it was a different trigger warning to normal, and it did say there would be one key moment with a racial slur, and that occurs in the second act, because, of course, when this generation of people from the West Indies came over to England, it was not all plain sailing, and they were not treated in a humane way, some of them. And so it is a really important historical story. It is hard to single out any one member of the cast, because those eight central characters were all phenomenal in their own right. So Julia Agnes, Gabrielle Brooks, Nathaniel Campbell, Khalid Daly, Danny Bailey, Jamal Franklin, Rachel John, Leanne Henlon, Gabriel Fleury, and Beth Elliott, and Carl Queensborough, Ashley Samuels. They were all just amazing singers, dancers, actors, and comedians. There was so much comedy. I was laughing. I had tearful moments. You know, moments when the hairs raise on your arm, and it was just such a strong production. And I met Julia Agnes after the show, one of the girls from the show, and we had a lovely chat, and it just shows you what culture and music was brought to Britain in the 1950s that has stayed with us. And I just hope it transfers to West End. It was so good. It was so good. And if musical theatre were on the A-level drama, you know, syllabus, I'd be taking students left, right and centre to see this. It's so strong.
Sorry, go back a bit. Musicals aren't on the syllabus?
No, you can take students to see as much theatre as possible. You create your own syllabus, but it's when you do your live evaluation of theatre, it is about plays. So that's kind of the rubric around it, because it hits with the assessment criteria of the, you know, the exam board and the overall examining body, which all the exam boards have to adhere to. But I take the students to see all sorts of my A-level students, for example. They tagged along with my year eights when we went to see Mrs. Doubtfire, because I obviously think it's important that students see every type and genre of theatre. But when they write about that one particular piece of theatre for their exam, it must be a play. So that's fine. But not all students are as lucky as my students and live near London and can get to see as much variety as my students get to see.
Yeah, no, for sure. Now, just looking on the website, it does look really good, and the production photography and stuff looks great. I mean, the cast, it's a big cast, actually. It's quite surprised. So, nice ensemble cast there and things, yeah. But, okay, well, obviously, you're very passionate about this one. So maybe I'm going to try and get a ticket. It does say limited tickets on some of the dates. And as you said, they are kind of like spec'd around. So if anyone is interested in going to see it, then absolutely book as soon as possible. So yeah, well done. Great work.
So Darren, a lot of theatre we've seen. And then you've been off interviewing again. Who did you talk to this time?
So I was talking to a lovely man called Brian Spector. Now, he is an investor and producer on Broadway and in West End shows. I mean, shows like Prima Facie, The Inheritance, The Berryman, Six. He's one of the backers of Six. So without, you know, people like him, those kind of shows wouldn't be in town. And he's got a new show which he's producing himself called Wild About You. And it's done as a concert, and it's starring one of our West End favourites, Rachel Tucker.
Ooh.
Yes, I do love Rachel Tucker, who I have worked with in the past. And Oliver Thompson, again, who I've worked with in the past. That's a name drop again. And starring, do you ever watch Will and Grace?
I have, but not. I'm not an avid watcher, but I know the peeps.
So Eric McCormick, who played Will, he's coming over to play the lead. So I'm really excited to see it. I mean, we're going to be watching it later in March. But I was very fortunate enough to get a nice detailed chat with Brian, actually, and hear more about what he does, you know, because obviously our listeners don't necessarily know what producers do. Obviously, I talk about it because I'm a producer, but from a Broadway perspective, and also what investors and stuff and how he got into it. So, this is what he had to say.
So I'm sitting here with Brian Spector. You are a two-time award-winning producer. You have a new show opening in London's West End called Wild About You, which is a really exciting cast. I mean, Rachel Tucker, Oliver Thompson. I'm not sure about Tori Allen Martin. I'm not someone I'm really familiar with, but of course I know Eric McCormick. So how did you get that cast? I mean, what's going on here?
Well, you know, we dreamcasted the world premiere recording that we released on November 17th under the Broadway Records label. Through all the wonderful connections my creative team had and a little assistance from casting. So we have high expectations, and we think that this piece deserves the best talent all around. And we hired Nick Winston as our director. And when we approached the casting in UK, we wanted a little flavor of US, but we wanted people who were just very talented and could give life to this production. So our goal was to cast each role with the top talent we could find. And I obviously, I know Eric. He was on our album. Ollie, I saw in Dreams in Toronto. I'm connected with that show. Rachel, I know because my first Broadway involvement was Come From Away, and I got to see her, you know, in London at the Phoenix. And I just, you know, I feel like these people could give life to this production. So we aimed high, and I think we're getting there. We have two more roles to fill. An offer is out. And one more we're deliberating on.
Ah, okay. So the world premiere, is a world premiere, isn't it?
It is a world premiere.
So that's the 25th and 26th of March. What can you tell us about the show?
Well, the show is, you know, I've been connected with the show for 6 or 7 years, Darren. I got friendly with Shalina through Jen Colella, who most people know was the recent star of Come From Away, and going to be in Suffs, another show of mine, on opening on Broadway in a couple months. And I consulted on the show for years, 6 or 7 years. And we decided to have a reading in March, 29 hour. The book always needed work, but I felt as if after this reading that I was meant to do it. So I took the option, and I was so blown away by the score, which is impeccable. I don't know if you've listened to the album yet, but it just soars. And the story had really evolved and grabbed me and grabbed everybody in the room. We have 50 people in the room. And that's why I decided this is the type of piece I want to be attached to and help move forward. It's the story of Olivia, who basically finds herself in a hospital with limited memory. She must dig through her messy past to figure out which of the loves of her life is her emergency contact. You can imagine that struggle. Some humor, some pathos, some sadness, only to understand, really, that her desire to make everyone happy during her life has basically left no one happy. So through a series of realizations, she reclaims her right to be flawed and loved in all her complexity. However, as she regains clarity, tragedy strikes. But that's when she literally has to move heaven and earth to reconnect with her greatest love, her son. And it is it's a story about loves, all different forms of loves, losses, and finding oneself. Very touching, very gripping, and the music really lifts it to another level.
Okay, so why did you want to be involved? Is it because of all you've just said then? Or is there any? How did you get involved in the first place? Did someone offer you it, or was it because of the workshop? Or,
well, I Shalina needed someone to executive produce the workshop, so my assistant Caitlin and I did that. And because I was so blown away by the results of the workshop, I'm the one that said to them, "I know workshops. You know, the workshop presentations, 29 hour readings are meant to find producers and investors. I think you found one." And I was delighted. They were delighted. And my only condition was, I want to do an album. I want to do the best album possible. I'm so impressed by the score and how it's evolved. And we did it. And it took us 4 months. We had Daniel Edmonds as our musical director and my fellow producer. And I'm so proud of it. I think it really is just, it turned out wonderful.
So why are you starting in the West End and not Broadway?
You know, first of all, I don't think anyone in my research has taken a show from a 29-hour reading to an album to a concert series in London. And I like challenges. I think London, to me, if you've looked at my book of work over the last 10 years, with the exception of Come From Away, every show I've done either as an investor or as a co-producer, it's come from London. And I feel like London is the best place to develop new theater now. I really do. I think both artistically, financially, and in terms of community support, it's ideal. And I'm not minimizing any component of that. The financial is significant. It's much less expensive to develop work in London than on Broadway or leading to Broadway. But I also think that it opens the door for, you know, new work, which is really what I focus on, new work. And developing that new work in a way that feeds off audiences and finds its direction.
So is the concert that you're obviously planning and is going ahead in March, is it with a view to having an extended full-length West End run? Is that your plan?
Everything's on the table, Jared. We've spoken to a few theaters already on this side, and I decided that we're really going to evaluate it after the concerts. We're going to see what we have, because the book's been tinkered with a bit. It's been, I think, significantly improved since the reading. And I want to see what the feedback is, what people say about it. Bill Harrison of Drury Lane said to me, you know, West End is a wonderful place to produce shows. So I'm open to considering West End as the, or off West End as the way to move this forward. I'm considering regional theater, nonprofit, and commercial here in the U.S. But a lot will be dictated by the concerts, how it's received, what people feel about it. It will find its right trajectory.
Yeah, no, I believe so. And I think that's, yeah, that's really cool. And obviously you can't predict the future if you don't actually know what the product can do yet. So yeah, yeah,
exactly.
Great idea. What brought you into the industry? I mean, you said that you've been a, you know, producer about 10 years. What was your first little kind of niggle into wanting to be a producer?
It's really a fun story. You know, one day I'm going to write a book. I should write a book about my whole life. But about 10 years ago, when I stepped down as National Alumni President for Syracuse University, one of our beloved schools and colleges here in the U.S., my vice president was Nina Keneally, who had won a Tony Award for Alfred Uhry's Last Night of Ballyhoo and had produced Good Vibrations. And she asked me for some tickets for the New York Yankees. I'm a baseball nut, as you can notice behind me. So I said, absolutely. She said, by the way, would you like to go to a reading? And I said, what's a reading? It was a reading of another Alfred Uhry piece called Divine Intervention. And I did go, and there were about a dozen people in the room, including Paul Rudd, Emily Mortimer, David Strathairn. And I was mesmerized by this whole process of developing theater. That show ultimately was not lifted, but it really hit me in a way I never expected. I wanted to learn everything I could about it. And so I met with Nina and her brother, Jamie Lightstone, another producer, to learn about the industry, bought a bunch of books, went to more readings, took CTI seminars here in New York, and evolved to doing my first off-Broadway show, which was Transport at the Irish Rep, written by Tom Keneally, who wrote Schindler's Ark, which became Schindler's List. I then went to do The Woodsman at New World. That's James Ortiz's puppetry imaginary one that won an Obie Award. At the same time was developing my first play, Steinbrenner, which didn't really go anywhere, but it was a great learning experience. I produced three readings, all sold out. My first Broadway venture was Come From Away and all of its productions. I then took a trip with a producer to London to see six or seven shows in a week in December of 19, including the first ever performance of Six at the Arts Center, at the Arts Theater.
I'm saying, yeah.
Which I later got involved in as an investor, Kenny Wax. And we fell in love with the Ferryman. So she produced it. I invested in it, won a Tony Award. I went on to my first co-producer role with Sonia Friedman in The Inheritance, which won a Tony. That was the first Tony. And then I went on to Leopoldstadt, which last year won the Tony, as well as I invested in Six, which was very successful, still it is. And I invested in Prima Facie, James Bierman's production, for which Jodie Comer won a Tony. So I've led a little bit of a charmed life. And in addition to Wild About You, I'm a co-producer of Suf's Shayna Taub's new musical opening in April, which I've been with for 6 years as a supporter. So I believe, as you can, two things. One, new work, and with the exception of Come From Away and Suf's, work that originated in London.
Yes, you've done quite a lot. I mean, looking at your website, you've definitely been heavily involved in a lot of big shows. And I think a lot of them I've seen. I'd love to see Suf's. So obviously, when's that opening on Broadway?
I think opening night... first preview is March 26th, the second night of our concert at Royal Drury Lane. But opening night is April 18th.
Okay.
Happy to hook you up with tickets, Darren.
Oh, I'd love to. I hopefully won't be out there in May, so that would be really, really cool. So thank you for that. I will definitely look out for that one. Your Tony Award, what was it like winning the first Tony?
You know, I'm not an awards guy. I hate to say it, sounds corny, but I got involved with theater. I'm one of the few people that got in theater not for awards and not for money, even though my recoupment percentage is, I think, interesting. I got involved because I want to be part of bringing the art form to the public. I enjoy seeing things being brought to stage and people being affected by them. Most of what I've done, except maybe for Six, obviously, are very meaningful spiritual pieces. They have a lot to offer, and they change people. So I didn't do it for the awards. But getting an award is, I guess, a reaffirmation of all the skills I bring to evaluating work and its potential, either artistically and or commercially. I felt good about that. I wasn't at the ceremony because of COVID, but I felt good about it. I felt even better for Matt Lopez, the writer, because he was the first Hispanic playwright to win a Tony. And I just thought it was wonderful. I know that The Inheritance was not as commercially viable as it was hoped, somewhat due to COVID, but also other issues. But I'm so proud to have been associated with the team that brought that to stage.
Did you get involved in The Inheritance UK, or was it just Broadway?
Just Broadway.
Okay, no, I loved it when it was in London. I don't know anyone that didn't see it, actually, so I think it had definitely a huge following here. Your theatrical company, is it Kika?
Kiaka.
Kiaka.
Productions. Everybody pronounces that way, so you're in the group.
Kiaka. Okay, I will remember that now. How did that come about? You got a story there, haven't you?
That was right after I was approached about taking over from, I forgot what it was, not Signature, not Playwright. One of the theater companies that was handling Steinbrenner, the authors, Ira Burko, Pulitzer Prize winner, and Bill Madden, a famous sports writer, to take over as producer of Steinbrenner. And my wife and I were celebrating our 30th wedding anniversary, retracing our honeymoon in Maui and San Francisco. So we got off a cruise and we were watching some hula dancers, kids doing hula dance in the mall on Kaanapali Beach. And I'm thinking, I'm a lawyer. I have to set up an entity to do this. I can't do all this personally. And I said, I wonder what the Hawaiian name for theater is. Kiaka. So I had my office form the company, Kiaka Productions, LLC, which is a lot like your LTD over there. And had a friend of mine design a logo that looked a little Hawaiian. And there we go.
Job done. No, I mean, it's a very impressive resume you have on your website. I had a really good look at it before we went on this call. But looking at
Let me tell you this, though. My most impressive thing is the people I've helped, not what I've done. The people I've helped with their projects, whether it's a playwright, a composer, a lyricist, a director, an actor, a singer, a dancer, the people I've affected their lives, and even the audiences that I've helped bring shows that made them happy, sad, made them think about things in different ways, that I'm more proud of than my credentials.
Yeah, I'm the same as a producer. That's why I set up my production company. It's now going to be 10 years old in May. But it's the same thing. It's to bring daring work to the stage and things that made me happy, like shows that I wanted to see put on stage, new writing, work with emerging creatives, you know, like kind of really find that next great talent. I mean, which leads me to my next question. If you could work with anybody that you haven't worked with before, who would it be?
That's interesting.
In any capacity, creative, artist, you know, another producer maybe, but yeah.
Well, you know, it's hard to answer that because, you know, working with David and Irene on Come From Away and then Jess Butterworth on Ferryman and Matt Lopez, and having met Tom Stoppard and worked with him on Leopoldstadt, having some wonderful conversations with him. You know, I'm a dreamy guy. I'd like to work with playwrights and composers and lyricists. You know, I would honestly, you know, this is not a plug for his theater, but I would love to work with Andrew Lloyd Webber one day. I think his genius is inexhausting. I think it'll be there forever. And I'm just putting aside Bad Cinderella for the moment, which I enjoyed.
I enjoyed it when he was in London.
And my dear friend was the alternate, another example of trying to help someone was the alternate Cinderella, Savvy Jackson, who I think's got a great future. But I would love to just spend time with him and get him to, you know, impart on me all of the wisdom he's gained, because I've only been in the business for 10 years. He defines the business. So it would be a toss up between him and Lin-Manuel, who I've never worked with, but have the world of admiration for him.
You're based in New York, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. So do you come to London much?
I've been to London. Well, I was there in December to meet with my team, obviously to get the tour and soak it all up. And the first time I stayed in the West End, so I got to really absorb myself. Saw three shows. Saw Operation Mincemeat, loved it. Saw Guys and Dolls, blown away, and saw Sunset Boulevard. Those are three nights in a row. I was in theater heaven, as they say. So I was there in December. I was there a few years ago for the first baseball game. I also caught Tina while I was there. And then I was there. I also saw Come From Away, by the way, which I had not seen in London. And on that trip in December of 17, seeing six or seven shows in 1 week with a fellow producer. And then I've been there a couple of other times in the late 90s with family. So I love London. And I love London more now than I did back in the late 90s. By the way, I saw Starlight Express and Oliver on my first trip there. So you can tell I have theater in my blood. But I love London now for a different reason. I see so much more potential for creativity, and the art scene is so, now post COVID, is so such a beautiful thing to experience, and it's so enriching. I'll be there in early March or rehearsals for this show. I'm looking forward to this show, but I'm also looking forward to all the other theater I can dabble in. I already have my tickets for The Hills of California. I wouldn't miss a Jez Butterworth play. So I'm excited about immersion in the London arts scene when I'm there. That's just a special feeling for me.
Not just so much as a producer, but just as someone who's passionate about theater, what do you think the main differences are between Broadway and West End?
Besides financial, of course.
Yes. Yes.
Right? I think there's a... I think West End in particular, and also off West End and your regional, Manchester, Edinburgh, all those, I think it generally, those theaters give new work more of a chance to develop and become good theater. There's more patience. There's more understanding. There's more of an ability to expand one's mind, to think of things that are different, new approaches. So I do think it's a better place to germinate new work. Look at Operation Mincemeat, for example. Who thought of what would happen with that? But it's just one example, even Six. And Kenny and Kevin's approach to that and how they've rolled that out. It just gives new theater a better opportunity. And that's a big difference. Broadway is so expensive, so hypercritical of work, so difficult to... You know, look at the closing of Harmony and How to Dance in Ohio. Those are beautiful pieces, but it's hard to give new work like that a chance.
Why do you think that is?
Different audiences, different financial models... different investor bases. I mean, there's some crossover in investors, a lot of U.S. invest in London, and then shows that transfer from West End to Broadway have a group of London investors who stay with them. But I just think it's a different psyche. You maybe it's Broadway's reputation. Maybe it's thought of a little bit more highly. But it's not easy. It's not as easy as it is in London to develop work. And it's obviously Broadway is much more financially lucrative if you do score. But that's why I've been drawn to these shows like Six, The Ferryman, The Inheritance, Leopoldstadt, because they've been in London. They've withstood the criticisms. They've been refined. They've been developed. And they come with somewhat of a ready-made reputation and audience when they transfer.
Yeah, because I've noticed more in London, especially on the posters and marketing, that you see a lot more names now than you ever used to before. Beforehand, it would be produced by so-and-so. That was it. The New York version is you have like 20 names above titles. That's becoming more and more the norm here now.
Well, it is because it's becoming more expensive in London to produce. So I may be guilty of that if we move forward on the West End as well. So I can't be too critical of it.
You know, fair enough. What is the biggest challenge you think in producing something new in the UK? This separate from Broadway, because I know the challenge is there, but for London, what do you think the biggest challenges are?
You know, if it's a new piece with new writers, and they may be recognizable even with great talent, it's finding your space, being heard above the noise. Because there's so much now post-COVID in London that the theater-going audience can experience, in not just in theater, but generally in the entertainment area. So the challenge is to break through with simple things like the name of your show, the colors that you use, the design, the people who you get to star in it, the theater you're located in. And I'm obviously very proud of Royal Drury Lane being the first theater I'm producing in London. Who gets that? But it's a lot of things. You have to hit the public, the audience, with everything you got. You can't just say, well, we'll tease this, we'll tease that. You got to hit with everything. You got to be rise above the others. You got to be heard through the noise. And I think that's a challenge in a lot of places, but especially in London, where there's a lot you can do.
Yeah, and moving on from that, there is so much going on in London. Why should an audience member buy a ticket for your show against someone else's? What's so special, you think, about grabbing a ticket for these two performances?
Let me tell you, and I say this even if I was tangentially involved and not so intimately involved, they will never hear a score at this stage of development like this score. Go listen to the album on iTunes and Spotify or whatever platform, and tell me you don't agree that this album is unique. They'll never hear anything like it. Not just in terms of the talent, the Broadway talent we've brought to bear, but the quality of the work, the quality of production, the lyrics, the melodies. We even have the Budapest Scoring Orchestra behind us in four songs. It's very unique. So the score, number one, you got to hear the score live. It's going to be spectacular. Two is the book. It's a very compelling, emotional story. Some laughter, you know, some humor, but very compelling. It's something they will never forget. And they will talk to other people about it. That's how good the book has become. And then the talent. We've given them some familiar faces, some newer faces. We've got Eric McCormick, who's always fun to watch. It's going to be an event. There really will be an event. Excellent. That they've never seen. And again, as I said in the beginning, nobody's ever brought something from a 29-hour reading to an album to a short concert series in London. Give it a try. I'm sure you'll be happy. It'll be well worth the expense.
No, I'm very much looking forward to it. And just because I know you're very busy, I just want to look at you've got obviously a nice section of baseballs behind you there, and you've got something else next door to your Broadway sign.
This isn't the sign. I did not steal that from Broadway. I found it at an antique store. And then as you and I chatted before a little bit, I was enamored by my visit to Royal Drury Lane. I had both two tours, one by the general management team and one by two actors. I was actually, that was the public tour but there was nobody else on that tour. So I got a private tour twice in 3 days. And coming out of the tour, I said to Victoria, one of the actors, I said, do you have a gift shop? I want to buy something I can bring home. And I saw they had a book, Star is Reborn, about the renovations at Theatre Royal Drury Lane, which are spectacular, by the way. And they spared no expense. I was mesmerized by the whole experience. So I bought the book, and I said, what is that piece of wood over there? And she brought down 6 slabs of wood. These are cheese boards we're selling. And I said, oh, the cheese board had an imprint of Theatre Royal Drury Lane. And I read it's at Stage 4, 1908-2019. I said, was that the Stage 4? She said, yes. I said, I have to buy it. And the two actors, if you look at the back, Victoria Jeffrey and Liv Spencer signed the board for me. And, you know, as I'm, you know, joking, they said, you know, Laurence Olivier and Dame Edna and Julie Andrews and so many others stepped on your cheese board. So I left with such a big smile on my face that I got to take home with me a piece of London theater history. I mean, the theater that I'm going to have my lead producer debut. I was just so touched by the whole experience.
No, that's pretty incredible. I mean, that's certainly something I would like to have picked up if I'd seen it as well. I like the quirky kind of little ornaments or knickknacks you get from theatres.
Yes.
Yeah. So
I'm the same way. I can show you, since these are London shows, I have so much
mugs.
Ferryman opening night on Broadway. A mug, because this is going to be audio, with the logo, and this is the inheritance, with the famous quote, one is at the beginning of the show, one may as well begin. So I have a lot of theater memorabilia, and I, you know, just, it's just, you know, part of me, that my experience.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for your time, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing Wild About You when it comes to London on March, was it 25th and 26th?
26th at Theatre Royal Drury Lane. And tickets are selling well. We're very happy. And stay tuned for announcement of the last 2 cast members. People will be duly impressed.
Why not grab a ticket to one of the shows mentioned in this podcast? Tune in next time and recommend us to your friends and family.
Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Theatre Audience Podcast and on Twitter at Theatre Audie Pod. Until the next time, goodbye and thank you for listening.